Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the podcast for Wednesday, January 5th. I'm Tammy DeRozier, and while Tom Dorsey is over on the rickshaw run in India, I have the pleasure of Paul Keaton joining me here from the Richmond, Virginia office. How are you, Paul? Yeah. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, and much prefer to be here than rumbling along the potholed streets that we've been hearing about from India for the past week or so. It's quite the journey. Can't wait for the first podcast when they get back.
Exactly. Yeah, it's been quite the journey. For those of you who don't know or haven't been listening to the podcast at the end of the year, Tom Dorsey, J. Greg Nanny, one of our analysts here in the office, one of our interns, Skip Carlton, and my husband are headed off to India in a rickshaw run. So it would be the equivalent of the old cannonball run, except in India, and except in a three-wheeled, seven-horsepower rickshaw. You can follow their journeys because they're blogging along the way, uploading photos. You can go to King Tux, and that's King and then T-U-K-S, Tux Chariot, or you can go to www.tuktuk.com, tuktuk.com, and follow their progress. They've got a GPS, so you can see them today. They are headed on their way to Pune, is where they're trying to make it to today in India. And so anyways, you can follow their progress there, so it's been quite an adventure. So. And we also have the pleasure of joining us today on our podcast, John Lewis from our Pasadena, California office. John, are you there?
I'm here. I'm certainly not in India, but, you know, I'm in California, so they're not fixing the streets since we're almost bankrupt, so we probably have as many potholes here as they do in India.
That is true. That's true, John. I'll tell you what. Well, congratulations have to go out to you guys managing the Aero DWA Balanced Fund, which came in the fourth percentile of all mutual funds in its category for 2010, which means that it outperformed 96% of all mutual funds in the moderate allocation category. So congratulations on that. Mm.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it was really a good year for that strategy. So, yeah, I mean, we're obviously very happy and very excited about that.
Well, and, you know, in 2011, in August, will be the five-year anniversary of that mutual fund as well, right?
Yeah, so, you know, we're looking forward to that. It was a big deal when we hit the three-year milestone, and now we're just looking forward to 5 years. So it doesn't seem like we've been doing it 5 years, but, you know, it's really been a good 5 years for that fund, and we're really happy with how that fund has been set up and how it's performed.
Well, give us a quick rundown, John, on exactly how that fund has set up for those that might not be familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Balanced Fund is a global balanced fund. And what we do is we have different relative strength models within one fund. So we'll run an alternative rotation model. We'll run some sector rotation, country rotation. There's five different rotation models that we run. We select the best relative strength investments in each one of those models. And then we also have a unique piece, which is an overlay where we will expand and contract the allocation to each one of those models based on relative strength. So in a real poor equity environment, we might have more fixed income. In an environment like we're in now where equities are doing well, we'll have more equities and a minimum allocation to fixed income. And it's just designed to go around the globe to where the relative strength is. It's very, very flexible. And we can do a number of different things in the portfolio, which is why it's been able to, I think, perform so well in a number of different types of market environments.
So what were some of the investments that you're in 2010?
Well, 2010, we've had a big exposure to alternatives. Gold and real estate was really where the exposure was. The commodity area for most of 2010 didn't do as well. You know, oil didn't do as well until the end of the year. So our investments were more gold and real estate. On the domestic style side, mid caps and small caps have really done much better in 2010, so we were there instead of in a large cap area. And then in the sector area, things like basic materials, industrials, some things that are more kind of in tune with this economic recovery theory, that's kind of how the portfolio is slanted. We also had, you know, a pretty big allocation to a number of different country funds, and a lot of those were more emerging markets focused and also more Asian focused rather than places like Western Europe or things like that.
Yeah, you know, and looking at our work, obviously, actually relative strength. It all works together. You know, you look at real estate, and it continues to be one of the top 10 of all the 40 DWA sectors going into 2011. So are you seeing any major changes as you're watching that portfolio, or any changes, you know, that might be close to changing, I guess that's just
the Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing we're seeing is maybe in that alternative area, and that didn't undergo many changes in 2010, but it seems like maybe some of the precious metals and some of the real estate stuff might be losing a little steam. And, you know, now that oil is picking up, a lot of these more broad commodity indexes are starting to do a little better. So while some of these things haven't, you know, fallen apart, the rankings are starting to drop a little bit. I remember for a lot of 2010, you know, real estate was, you know, the number one sector, and now, you know, it's kind of fallen back to number 10. So you see, it's maybe, you know, it hasn't fallen out of bed. You don't necessarily want to get rid of it, but we're watching those changes, and we're seeing some of the other stuff start to pick up. There's no, major changes imminent, but that's kind of the area that we're watching most closely. Otherwise, a lot of those trends kind of seem to be in place from 2010, which we think bodes very, very well for, you know, at least the first part of 2011.
Yes, interesting point, John, because you think about 2010, I guess one of the reasons that relative strength was so successful is not, you know, there are always, you know, some things that do well and some things that do not as well in a given year, but it just sort of so happened that in 2010, you think about international equities, I mean, the worst performing areas in a lot of cases were, you know, the most invested areas for a lot of the benchmarks, and for commodities, kind of the same thing. You know, crude is really, you know, the tail that wags the dog for most commodity portfolios, and yet that was really one of the most lagging aspects, and certainly energy in general was the most, you know, lagging aspect of the commodity markets, you know, in 2010.
You know, and I think it could be interesting, too, as we look that, you know, there was a pretty big spread sometimes within some of the asset classes, but between the asset classes, like you said, looking at those benchmarks, there wasn't as big of a spread between the best and the worst. That it was about half of what the average spread was. So when we go back and we look at that historically, when you get those smaller averages, they tend to start ballooning out over the next several years, which would bode well for a relative strength strategy, right, John?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point between the overall, you know, the dispersion of the asset classes versus the dispersion of the investments within the asset classes. So you make a good point in that, you know, on a macro level, a lot of the asset classes perform very in a similar fashion, and maybe, you know, the dispersion was not any more or it was less than it normally is. But then within some of these things, like within the domestic market, there was plenty of dispersion, or within the developed international market, there's plenty of dispersion. So it, you know, relative strength kind of affected each one of these areas in a different way. And if you had a focus strategy, for example, it was a little easier to outperform. On a kind of macro level area, it was a little more difficult to outperform using relative strength because there just wasn't as much dispersion. There was a lot of back and forth in the dollar, which affected a lot of those macro asset classes.
Which I think is the beauty of this strategy with respect to the balance fund is the fact that it is a two-tiered analysis, as you stated in the beginning, that it's analysis within the asset class and then also analysis between the asset classes. So no matter where that dispersion is, if it's occurring within the asset class like it was in 2010, we can take advantage of it. Or maybe in a year like 2011 or other years, it might be something that we can take advantage of between the asset classes. You know, maybe the 2011 shows that, you know, equities is a huge dispersion between the fixed income space or, you know, whatever the case may be. So you can take advantage of either one of those that go forward, which I think is really speaks to so much of the flexibility of this strategy, so as a core piece of the portfolio. And that's one thing we've talked about on these podcasts in the past, that one of the things that you could do as a piece or sleeve, a satellite of your portfolio, the third leg of your portfolio is that you could take the balance fund, put that in at 35%, put the tactical fund in at 35%, and then each of our three ETFs, the PDP, the PI, and the PIS, which is technical leaders for U.S. markets, developed markets, and emerging markets. So those five pieces right there could be a sleeve of your portfolio or a satellite piece of your portfolio right there. And that did extremely well in 2010 as well. How are those ETFs poised going into 2011, John?
Yeah, there's, there weren't real huge changes in them. Those trends kind of seem to be, in place and holding from 2010 going into 2011. So, we make changes to them at the end of every calendar quarter, and they'll stay in place through the next 3 months until, that next calendar quarter comes up. The trends that we saw in 2010 are pretty much in place. PDP, for example, we still have a lot of exposure to the consumer cyclical area, the industrial area, and the technology area. And that was, kind of a big theme throughout 2010. So we're just kind of seeing those themes continue into 2007, which, as I said earlier, I think really bodes well for at least the first part of 2011, because we're not seeing any of these major shifts in asset classes or sectors, which are the times when relative strength strategies tend to lag.
Now, expand upon that a little bit when you say, the first part of the year in January, that, a lot of times you see relative strength lag. What do you mean by that? What do you see happening?
Well, the January effect affects relative strength stocks and securities oftentimes much more than a lot of other types of securities. And the reason for that is that, no one's really conclusively proven why, but the theories are really it's kind of a tax-based type of phenomenon. So if you have very strong stocks in your portfolio and you need to sell some of them to rebalance, you generally wait until the next year in January to delay that tax bill. So you'll sell your losers in December and you'll wait till January to sell your winners. So a lot of times in January, you'll see the high IRS stocks might have a little bit more, disproportional selling in January. Maybe some of that should have been in December, but it's been held off. And you'll see some of these academic studies where they'll look at different factors based on relative strength, and they will run them oftentimes with 12 months, and then they will also exclude the month of January. And pretty much without fail, the factor works better for the other 11 months than, when you exclude January.
So it sounds like to me any pullbacks then in a relative strength strategy in January are really actually going to be opportunities to buy, I think, here. Don't you think, Paul?
They generally are if you get them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. You think about what the best performing asset in 2010 was, at least when we look at, let's say the ETF universe, it was silver. And then the first two and a half trading sessions for 2011, I mean, I don't think we've seen anything sold more violently than have those silver ETFs in the first couple of days.
Yeah.
Silver also had a few, scary days in 2010. I remember the exchange, up the margin requirements, and there was a huge sell-off, and, just turned right around and powered back up to new highs. So, those high relative strength assets can be very volatile like that, and oftentimes the pullbacks are really good buying opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you talk about that. I had a call the other day from an advisor talking about Australia and all of the flooding that's happening there, and should, they were holding some of the Australian ETFs and wondering whether now, should we come out of those or should I just wait for the chart to give a sell signal? I said, you look back at Thailand's chart, and you look at the political unrest that was happening there, and the chart went through some consolidation, but never really broke down. It stayed in one of our ETF models, and then, as you said, it just powered on to new highs. It was one of the best performing ones. So it's that sticking to that discipline that makes the big difference, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the high relative strength securities are often very difficult to trade, and having that discipline is really essential, because oftentimes they don't really do what you expect they're going to do because they're not fully understood, and that's why they're doing so well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, you know, we talk about the one of the themes in 2010 that I think is really interesting is the fact that developed markets with the debt crisis and so forth were really underperformers compared to the emerging markets, and that's where the focus was in the mutual fund. But we also have an ETF for the developed markets, the PowerShares Developed Markets Technical Leaders, and that performance compared to the benchmark was astounding. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the spread of PIZ compared to the Developed Markets Index, which is EFA, and you can get EFA, which is an ETF based on EFA, you know, it was huge. And right. it was pretty easy.
Yeah, I was going to say, excuse me for interrupting, John, but the PIZ was up 20.45% last year, and the EFA was up 5.3%. last year.
Hmm. But yeah, and that's kind of what we're talking about with that dispersion in returns, you know, within a narrower asset class, because if you think back to 2010, you have these debt crises, and they were, you know, focused kind of in one area. So since we're using relative strength, we're just excluding those areas from the portfolio, and we've got more exposure maybe to Asia, and just these other assets. They're not, you know, financial assets. We're, you know, looking at more basic materials exposure or things like that. So, you know, by being able to exclude those things, really enables you to, you know, generate a tremendous amount of outperformance when you've got that large dispersion in returns.
Now, was there any changes that you could notably see within the PIE or the PIZ last year? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the big things in PIE was, you know, a big underweight in China. Mm-hmm. And, you know, China really was not a great performer in 2010. Heading into 2011, you know, obviously we're underweight there as well. On the emerging market side, we've got big weights in Indonesia, Korea and Mexico, and you know those areas have been very, very good performers versus the other emerging markets countries. So that's really kind of where the big overweights and underweights are on the emerging side. On the developed side, you know, Singapore is we've liked Singapore for a long time. England has a big weight. You know, they haven't had the banking issues in 2010 that some of the other areas in Europe have had. You know, Hong Kong is big in that portfolio as well, and that's, you know, kind of that Asian theme and, you know, a little bit, you know, moving out of the Western Europe and banking and things like that. We have very little exposure relative to financials in the developed markets, which I think is something that you would expect based on a relative strength type model.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the PIZ, too, it just broke a double top when you look at the chart as well.
Mm. Yeah, right, and new rally highs, and so, I mean, certainly appears that the trends that, you know, were effective in 2010 are still, you know, thus far effective early in the year.
And if they change in 2011, I think that's the most important thing, is that if they change, then that will be reflected in the portfolios as well. You know, when we went back and looked at how this methodology would have worked in years like 2000, you saw that rotation out of technology into other sectors. In 2007, 2008, we saw the rotation out of energy there in the middle part of 2008 after oil crude's topped out at about $140 a barrel, and those things started to sell off. There was a rotation out of those areas there. So those are some of the major themes that I can think of, John, with respect to some of the rotation we've seen in the models. Any others that you can think of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, the models are designed to be very flexible and very adaptive. And, you know, I mentioned we had a big underweight in China, but at times that's been a huge overweight in PIE. So, you know, we have really no bias where we want to be over or underweight. We just let the, you know, the market prices of all these individual securities versus the other stuff in the universe just dictate where we overweight and underweight. And it's very, very flexible. It's very adaptive. And it changes over time based on where the performance is.
You know, what the other things that I noticed yesterday, John, when I was looking at charts was, and Paul, we were talking about it and for the report, is that there are quite a few small cap international ETF breakouts. Would you say that the PIE and PIZ tend to have a little bit more of a small cap focus? Because the PIZ also broke out yesterday, too.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's, you know, like a small cap focus, because we do kind of screen for trading liquidity because some of these markets are very difficult to trade. And, you know, we do have, you know, fair amount of turnover in these in order for them to adapt. But compared to the bigger benchmarks, EEM or EFA, things like that, we do have a lot more kind of small mid-cap exposure right now. There still is some large cap in there. It's not solely, a mid-cap or small cap fund, but definitely versus the bigger benchmarks, we have, we're moving down on that capitalization scale, and that's, probably why these are doing a lot better than their benchmarks, because we're focusing, a little more of our assets on the, mids and smalls rather than the large cap area.
Exactly.
Yeah, you didn't mention Brazil, John. I thought you might, because to me that was one of the most more, maybe material underweights in that emerging markets fund, because Brazil has been such the, I guess maybe the poster child of emerging markets or it's been kind of the intuitive thing. You remember, I guess it was, almost 2 years ago now, that they had the big cover on The Economist, and it was Brazil takes off, and that was about the time they, were awarded with the World Cup and the Olympics and all these things. Everything seemed to be going right for Brazil and for their economy, and maybe it has been, but, when you look at, the MSCI Brazil indexes relative to all these other emerging markets, it's the largest weighting in the, MSCI, the emerging market fund, but it's been, seems to be out of sync performance-wise, and I noticed that's one of the kind of material underweights, I guess, in the PIE fund.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have an underweight to Brazil, and over the last year, for example, that, Brazil ETF has really underperformed EEM, and that's just part of that process. I mean, I think a lot of people are very excited about Brazil and what's going on, but the performance just hasn't been there. So that, the process that we use just kind of automatically goes through, and it recognizes that, it's just not performing as well, and it, it might only buy, a few of the real good performers, but it's not going to really overweight the entire country.
And I think too, the other thing that struck me as we were talking here and talking about some of that smaller cap, mid cap exposure, that we talk about emerging markets doing well, that I think sometimes people forget that the small caps here in the U.S., the smaller cap, mid caps within the developed markets can also be considered emerging, so to speak. These are the new up and coming emerging countries, and so sometimes you don't necessarily have to go to an emerging country to get that exposure sometimes in this global economy too. So just another thought there as well. Well, John, I just wanted to say thank you for coming on with us today. Again, congratulations. The indices and ETFs and all have done fantastic in 2010. We're looking forward to 2011 and excited about the way that we see people utilizing these in their portfolios. So thanks for joining us. I know you've got another conference call to hop on. So.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's always good to come on and talk about this. And, 2010 was a real good year for RS, and, we think 2011 is starting out to be real good as well, so we're excited about it.
In fact, on your blog, you all have a blog called systematicrelativestrength.com. There was an interesting article about, major trends in relative strength itself, and we're talking about trends over 100 years, about how relative strength goes through periods of strong outperformance, and then it has a couple years it'll struggle, and then goes through those periods of outperformance. So you've got an interesting article on that on your blog, so I'll encourage people to go to systematicrelativestrength.com. Thanks again, John. Appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's always a great conversation, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, it's good. And, it's just it's such an interesting, year in 2010, because it's such a good reminder of the opportunities that tactical rotation offer you when you look at all of these strategically weighted benchmarks and the inflexibility that they have. You begin to see, crises, let's say, in Western Europe, and you see the euro collapse, and you see the Western European markets and Japan, and you see these things underperform, but the benchmark indexes are incapable of adapting in any sort of meaningful time frame. I mean, these things, most of them are market cap weighted or GDP weighted, or things, things that take a very, very long time to change. And sure, over time, 30 years from now, China will be the largest weighting, let's say, in a developed market fund. But again, that takes a long time. And when you look at a year like 2010, it's just it's very interesting, because so many of the things that were the largest weightings in strategically weighted funds were just ended up being you know, holding a lot of things that were lagging assets. Western Europe was certainly one. 2010, I think, you know, energy within the commodity funds really held back some of those, like the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, for instance. And emerging markets, you know, Brazil, very good example. You know, the MSCI Brazil fund was only up less than 4% in 2010, where, you know, the emerging markets benchmark was up 15%. So, you know, and that's the largest weighting. So it's tough to have good performance when your largest weighting is holding you back like that, and you can't adapt.
Yeah, that's right, and you can't adapt. And, you know, and talking about adapting, I think one of the things that we noticed in 2010 for sure was the amount of money that went into fixed income ETFs. So it was one of the largest growing space, tremendous amount of money that went into that area. And it did pretty well from April until October, November or so. And then fixed income has really started to fall off. And so you see that adaptability in like the balance fund to take that asset class, move it down. And the thing about the relative strength and the strategies here is that it helps you discern just bounces. You know, fixed income's really been falling pretty precipitously here in the November, December time frame. So that particular asset class may well be due for a little bit of a bounce here off the bottom. But is that bounce sustainable? You know, is it going to turn into a new trend? And that's where the charts really come in and provide you that discipline to be able to step back and objectively look at it. Same thing as you mentioned with gold and silver pulling back here the first couple of days. Has that materially changed the chart at this point? I'd have to say probably not, right?
Mm-hmm. No, even though that's, you know, we've gotten a ton of calls and a ton of questions, and it's never fun, you know, to see something that has been such a good long-term performer, and therefore, you know, on a technical basis, on a relative strength basis, you've had every reason in the world to own gold and silver, and you were extremely well rewarded over the past year for that. But, you know, it doesn't make it any more fun to see, you know, 5% pullbacks in silver in a day. But that's, again, you know, if you look at that and you're selling, I mean, the only reason you really have to say you're selling is maybe I'm panicking, I'm scared, you know, I think it might go down further. But, you know, when you look at the prevailing trend for silver and for gold and for most of the major metals, in fact, you know, copper as well has pulled back off its highs. I mean, these are things that over the past week have just gone to new highs. And they've pulled back now to where they're at least not extremely overbought near term.
That's right, and I think that's that comment, you know, really struck me when John was talking about how relative strength tends to lag here in this first month in January as people push off the selling. And that certainly, as you pointed out, big case in 2010 carrying into 2011 here was especially some of the tremendous returns from some of that strong relative strength work. And you look at a lot of the guided ETF models, those types of things, and you see that, wow, they're up near the top of the trading bands. These things look like they're ready to cool off a little bit. So, you know, any pullbacks to me are opportunities to take new monies and push those to work, especially as long as, you know, we have just about every asset class still being favored over cash right now. Commodities being favored over cash, U.S. equities and international equities.
And, you know, it's interesting because you always have that, there's that certain fear that you get within a strong trend that, you know, if I don't buy these things here, they're just going to keep going up without me. Mm-hmm. And then at some point you sit down and you say, well, God, you know, I hear all this fundamental stuff about why, you know, gold can go to $3,000 an ounce or silver can double from here and mm-hmm. whatever. And I've got all these technical reasons to buy it. I just need to buy it. I don't care how overbought it is. And you realize that, you know, there's any number of things that can happen that cause a pullback. It's, you know, when you look at any long-term trend, you take a look at it and you'll see that, you know, within those trends, you get those exhales, you get those consolidations, and, you know, who can predict, you know, what will be the cause? Maybe it's, you know, as we saw back in, I think it was October, where the CFTC changed their margin requirements for, you know, silver and for gold, I think. And suddenly, you know, you had, just for margin calls, you had, you know, an exhale from some of those precious metals. You know, as John mentioned, you know, early in this year, maybe it's just the tax implications and pushing capital gains taxes out into the new year that you get a pullback in gold and silver. Who knows? But generally, when we're patient, when we force ourselves to only to enter with a good risk reward, you know, we're generally rewarded with a much better scenario for owning securities.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly saw it happen several times in 2010. Like you mentioned, October, you saw that April to July period give us those pullbacks after getting up on that spike in April too. So, so you want to be patient and stick with the discipline here. So I think that'd be what we take going into 2011. Well, thanks for joining me this week, Paul. It's been a pleasure, and it was our pleasure to have John on. We want to wish everybody a happy New Year, and we'll be back on with you next Wednesday.